Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you for spending some part of your Valentine's evening with Vanderbilt University and the Center for the Study of Religion and Culture. And it's happy Valentine's Day. I just want to be on the record because they also are filming this for public television, and so you will note that I will escape immediately after my introduction. Fortunately, we're going to have an opportunity to hear I'm going to have an opportunity to see our speaker on television, and then he's going to be with us for at least three other times, and I cherish that. I apologize, but on this evening, I have yet a couple of more speaking engagements, and I'm going to try to make it home and repair my relationship with my wife while I'm doing that also. So it's wonderful to have all of you here. But tonight, I would say, in the spirit of the evening, is a sweet Valentine for Vanderbilt. We welcome Professor Rodney Stark as Vanderbilt University's first Templeton Research Fellow. Professor Stark's presence as a speaker at Vanderbilt is supported by a Templeton Research Lecture Grant awarded to the center. Over the next 3 years, Vanderbilt's Templeton Grant will fund a research group, lectures, publications, and a major conference. The Templeton Grant, funded by the John Templeton Foundation, was awarded to the Center for the Study of Religion and Culture through the MetaNexus Institute, which supports research, education, and outreach toward the constructive engagement of science and religion. For those of you only newly acquainted with it, may I say that MetaNexus is a MetaNexus indeed. At this moment, responsible for coordinating and facilitating 300 projects in 30 nations, including this grant, to our own center. The Center for the Study of Religion and Culture is a thriving and enormously successful example of Vanderbilt's trans-institutional centers, which were made possible with the creation of the Academic Venture Capital Fund 5 years ago. Collaboration among institutions, departments, schools, and disciplines enables innovative thought, in this case, new ways of taking religion seriously by studying and discussing religion through a sociological, ecological, or even economic lens. I'm pleased this evening, therefore, to introduce to you Volney Gay, co-director of the center, who will introduce to you our distinguished speaker. We always have to introduce those who are going to speak and then introduce additional people. In this instance, though, I am delighted to be able to introduce Volney because he is a sterling example of what is great about Vanderbilt. Professor Gay directs the Center for the Study of Religion and Culture, along with Douglas Knight, who is back there in the back, acting very incognito, professor of Hebrew Bible. Volney Gay is professor and chair of the Department of Religious Studies, professor of psychiatry, and professor of anthropology at Vanderbilt University. He simply could not make up his mind about his academic disciplines. His research interests encompass the psychology of religion and the psychodynamic study of culture. He is currently at work on a new book project which will demonstrate that the rate of progress in the sciences is faster than the rate of progress in the humanities due to the differing nature of the respective subjects. Science studies that which is apparent, evident, and can be empirically tested, and therefore progresses much more rapidly than the humanities that attempt to decipher a subject, human nature, which is so much more elusive and difficult to map. I wish I were going to be here to see that discussion, as a matter of fact. Tonight's lecture by Professor Stark will offer a new approach to mapping human nature. Ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed my pleasure, indeed my honor, to present my friend and my colleague, Volney Gay. Volney?
If you examine the Vanderbilt University webpage, you will discover that four entities or groups study religion: the Divinity School, the Graduate Department of Religion, the Department of Religious Studies, and the Center for the Study of Religion and Culture. Why four? Because religion has that complexity and that depth. We have discovered that it deserves four very different takes. Each group is valuable and each serves vital needs. The Divinity School was founded in 1875 with the opening of the university. It offers two degrees, the MDiv and the MTS. These degrees educate professional persons to go out and serve religious and social institutions. The Graduate Department of Religion, what we call the GDR, was founded in 1942. It offers the MA and PhD degrees. The mission of the GDR is to train scholars and teachers for college and university service. As of December 2003, the GDR had awarded more than 500 PhDs, making it the largest number of doctorates offered by any department in the graduate school at Vanderbilt. The Undergraduate Department of Religious Studies was founded in 1968. It is situated within the Humanities Division of the College of Arts and Sciences. Religion majors earn the BA. And finally, this, the Center for the Study of Religion and Culture, was born 3 years ago. The mission of the center is to foster integrated research on religion and culture across the 10 schools that make up this great university. Its directors are Douglas Knight and me. Mark Justad is the executive director. The CSRC, as Gordon noted, has funded a number of projects. There are five right now, large-scale, multi-year groups. Six more projects are in development. The five we funded are Religion, Economy, and Poverty, Ecology and Spirituality in America, Religion and Genetics, Music, Religion in the South, and Religion and Science. In 2005, the Religion and Science Group, directed by Richard Haglund and me, won a grant from the Meta-Nexus Institute to carry out a three-year project. This grant let us establish the Templeton Research Lectures. Each year, for 3 years, we will bring to Vanderbilt and to Nashville an outstanding scholar to address key issues in science and religion. Rodney Stark is the first TRL in 2006. Before I introduce Rodney, though, let me introduce first Miss Lauren Templeton, a grandniece of Sir John Templeton, whose generosity and foresight made the TRL possible. Lauren C. Templeton earned her BA degree in economics from the University of the South in 1998. Lauren is the founder and president of Templeton Capital Management, an alternative investment firm located in Suwanee, Tennessee. Currently, Templeton Capital Management oversees about $160 million in funds. Lauren is also the president and founder of the Southeastern Hedge Fund Association based in Atlanta. A true builder, Lauren helped establish sister organizations in Dallas, Chicago, San Francisco, Denver, and New York. She has helped bring young women especially into hedge fund management. Lauren is the great niece of Sir John Templeton and is a member of the John M. Templeton Foundation. Like her illustrious great uncle, Lauren is committed to development, both economic and spiritual. Please welcome Lauren.
That was a great introduction. I need one of those every day when I go to work. So, happy Valentine's Day, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished faculty. It is with great pleasure that I am here with you this evening as a representative of the John M. Templeton Foundation. My name is Lauren Templeton. I'm the great niece of Sir John. Sir John was born and raised down the road in Winchester, Tennessee. I drove here tonight from Winchester. Sir John graduated from Yale University and was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University. As a leader in both financial investments and spiritual endeavors, John Templeton has spent a lifetime encouraging research and discovery and open-mindedness. He is universally regarded as a pioneer in the development of global investing, founding the highly successful Templeton Growth Fund and Templeton World Fund. His first major philanthropic endeavor was the Templeton Prize. The Templeton Prize is awarded each year to a living person to encourage and honor those who advance spiritual matters, including research in love, creativity, purpose, infinity, intelligence, thanksgiving, and prayer. First awarded in 1973 to Mother Teresa. Currently, the Templeton Prize is worth more than $1.4 million. The Templeton Prize is the world's largest annual monetary prize given to an individual. In 1997, Sir John was knighted by Queen Elizabeth for his philanthropic efforts, including his endowment of Templeton College to Oxford University. After selling the Templeton Funds in 1992, Sir John focused his talents and pioneering new ways of encouraging science methods towards discovering over 100-fold more about spiritual realities such as love, prayer, and creativity. In 1987, he created the John M. Templeton Foundation. I've had the great pleasure to work with Sir John on several projects in the investment area. And I have to say that his approach to investing and philanthropy are quite similar. Sir John Templeton is often praised for being a contrarian investor. When the market is most scared, he is confident. And when the same group becomes too confident, he begins to worry. There is an old story in our family that I think sheds some light on this practice and where it came from. When Sir John was a young boy and the U.S. was in the midst of Great Depression, his father, my great-grandfather, was a lawyer in Winchester and occupied an office overlooking the town square. As the economy fell into its most bleak stages, it was common for farms and houses to be auctioned off by banks on the square. During this time, my great-grandfather would observe from his office window, and in cases where no bidders for the properties emerged, he would walk down to the square and buy land for what amounted to cents on the dollar. Through observation, one of the world's most famous value investors was born. Sir John was then a boy, and he learned an early contrarian lesson: to buy when others are despondently selling. More simply put, he learned to see immense future value in what at the time was judged by the wider population as nearly worthless. Sir John's ability to detect the hidden value in things extends well beyond simple assets for sale in the market. An easy example can be seen in his active philanthropy. When the Templeton Foundation began, it was responding to a tremendous void in the market for research on spirituality. In other words, there was no real value being placed on the need to discover and infinitely expand people's understanding of spirituality. In the meantime, the value and overall worth of what could be discovered far exceeds what amounts to, in comparison, small amounts of money spent on the process. Taken in this light, it's simple to see how his foundation fits into his philosophy of going against the grain and investing small sums to create overwhelming value, but in this case, not for his own personal gain, but on behalf of mankind. So, Vanderbilt joins Columbia University, the University of California in Santa Barbara, Stanford University, UCLA, and University of Arizona, and the University of Pennsylvania in hosting this exciting three-year project. Congratulations to Vanderbilt's Center for the Study of Religion and Culture for winning this competitive grant, which should fund the work of an interdisciplinary committee over the next 3 years and this annual lectureship, which we launched tonight. Thanks also to Dr. William Grassi and his team at MetaNexus Institute, who managed this project on behalf of the Templeton Foundation. Thank you.
The last introduction. The first TRL is Professor Rodney Stark. Rodney earned his BA in journalism at the University of Denver, then his MA and PhD degrees in sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. While still a graduate student, Rodney co-authored 4 books. That's more than usual. He journeyed north to the University of Washington, go Huskies, was made full professor almost immediately, and remained there for about 30 years. In 2004, Professor Stark joined Baylor University, go Bears, where he is university professor of the social sciences. In 1987, Rodney co-founded and directed the MicroCase Corporation. MicroCase offers a software package of statistical programs and a vast library of sociological data. Numerous scholars and students use MicroCase, including senior scholars at Vanderbilt. Rodney has published more than 25 books as of last week, many of them classics in the field. His textbook, Sociology, is now in its 9th edition. He wrote it because there were no better around, and now it's the best that is. His 1996 book, The Rise of Christianity, was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. Other important books focus on prejudice, crime and deviance, methodology, the Mormons, American church history, the rise of new religions, and most recently, the growth of science and its origins in monotheism. Rodney is no stranger to controversy. Andrew Greeley, another eminent sociologist and novelist, says of Rodney, "Stark is a giant comparable to Max Weber and Emil Durkheim. Weber and Durkheim are the Babe Ruth and Joe DiMaggio of sociology." I'm not sure what that makes you. In Greeley's words, arguing, refuting, dismissing, challenging, stamping his feet, pounding the table, and occasionally tossing an intellectual bomb, Stark continually throws the discipline of sociology of religion into chaos. Speaking for Doug Knight, Mark Justad, Richard Hagland, we welcome all those activities. I'm sorry, though, that we have no table for you to pound upon. In the beginning was chaos and struggle. After chaotic struggle came clarity, and with clarity came cosmos. Universities exist to harness the creative power of chaos. We wrestle order from it and to make thinking possible. Speaking on the market approach to understanding religion, please welcome Professor Rodney Stark.
Been a long time since I've done this, and so I wasn't quite sure which glasses to wear, and I'm still not, so I'm going to take a peek. These. Wish my parents had been here. Introduction like that. My father would have been very proud. My mother would have believed it. It has been a long time. I'm used to teaching 800 undergraduates in one big room, and 5 years ago I walked out and haven't done that anymore. And this is the biggest audience I've had since then. So thank you for coming. These four lectures are based on what has come to be called the market approach to religious phenomena. So it seems appropriate to start by summarizing a little bit what that means. Some of my critics like to pretend, of course, that what it means is vulgar materialism. But let me assure you that the sacred character of religion is fully appreciated. In fact, it's given primary importance. In a competitive situation, religious groups that project only hazy images of divinity soon get plowed under. And as that suggests, the distinctive feature of the market approach is to emphasize the activities of religious organizations and to place greater emphasis on religious supply than on religious demand. Now I can see you. Most of its history, the social sciences have stressed need when they've approached the subject of religion. Demand is what I call it, but the idea is, of course, that religion is caused by thwarted desires, by neurosis, by ignorance, by fear, by the Oedipus complex, by false consciousness, and all sorts of other human failings. In contrast, the market approach makes the assumption that people are about as reasonable about their religious behavior as they are about anything else they do. Of even greater importance in distinguishing the market approach is the fundamental insight that most variations in expressed religious demand is caused by variations in the effectiveness and the diversity of religious suppliers. Do many religious groups compete for followers, or in many sad cases, does the state collaborate with one group in an effort to impose a monopoly? Let me illustrate the importance of the shift from demand to supply. When confronted with major shifts in the religious composition of societies, as when, say, people left the Church of England to become Methodists, or deserted pagan temples to become Christians, or simply abandoned the Swedish state church, proponents of other approaches usually pose the basic question is, why did people's religious preferences change? That seems entirely reasonable. But when we pose the question that way, we're directed to seek our answer in shifting demand and to conclude that these changes occur because people suddenly developed or somehow came to have unmet new religious needs. And so they turned to new or invented new religious organizations to meet these needs. So we can say the rise of Methodism had to do with growing class conflict. The defection of pagans to Christianity was long attributed to the arrival of an age of anxiety, whatever that is. And the very low level of participation of modern Swedes in the Swedish National Church has been attributed to the fact that people have lost their need for religion, perhaps because the socialist state is providing adequate substitutes. I think these are the wrong questions, but the wrong answers, but I also think that they're trying to answer the wrong question. There's considerable evidence that over time, although sometimes it remains quite latent, that religious demand is fairly constant, and that most religious change is produced by variations from the supply side. That while religious demand sits constant, suppliers rise and fall, and the overall level of religious participation is a function of the diversity and the energy of religious suppliers. So the fundamental question from my view is, why are some religious organizations unable to compete with new challengers? Or why do some religious organizations change so they no longer enjoy mass appeal? Or more specifically, what was wrong with the Church of England? What did paganism lack? And why has the Swedish state church made so little effort to attract and hold an active membership? The key to this kind of an approach is the idea of a religious economy. That's a term that offends all sorts of people, but I will continue to use it. What's a religious economy? Everything religious going on in the society. That is to say, it's a market of current and potential adherents, members, a set of one or more organizations seeking to attract or maintain adherents, and the religious culture offered by these organizations. That's what makes a religious economy. Now, the most critical aspect of the religious economy, interestingly enough, you have to go back to the demand side to find. And that's because people differ in their religious tastes. If we were to rank people on a scale of intensity from wanting very intense religion down to wanting, well, not really very much religion, but maybe a little bit, we'd find something that looked a little bit like a normal curve, with some people wanting a lot, some people wanting very little or none, and lots of people kind of scattered in the middle. The importance of this diversity, which I think there's good evidence you can find in primitive societies, you can find everywhere around the world, pretty much the same stable sort of distribution, is that all religious economies or religious markets consist of niches, stable sets of people sharing distinctive preferences, tastes, needs, expectations, whatever you want to call them. And the fact remains that no single organization can meet all of these tastes and expectations because no one organization can be intense and lax, very otherworldly and very worldly. I mean, it just is not. So the natural state of any religious economy is pluralism. The existence of an array of suppliers, each appealing to particular niches, often competing for them. And under conditions of pluralism, religious organizations, since you will find a number of them now, can usually be also arrayed along an axis from the sect at the one end to the church at the other, that is to say, the worldly and the lax down to the intense and the otherworldly. And this leads to the fundamental insight that competition among religious organizations in any society stimulates effort by each organization to attract and hold a segment of the market. Competition, therefore, increases the overall level of public religious commitment. It also causes the demise of faiths that fail to compete effectively, whether that's from sloth, as it often is, or from lack of sufficient market appeal, or there being just too darn much competition. Now, I've said that pluralism is the natural state, but it is not the usual state of a religious economy. Typically, pluralism has been suppressed in favor of religious monopolies. Like all monopolies, religious monopolies are artificial. They exist only to the extent that coercive force is utilized to prevent competition. Coercion doesn't need to involve naked force. Many governments in contemporary Europe employ far less brutal techniques than that to place all religious groups other than the state church at a severe disadvantage. Like, go to Sweden, they'll let you start a Baptist church, but they won't give you a building permit. Okay? See how it works. However it is that pluralism is impeded, the result will be religious dissatisfaction, apathy, and antagonism, since the religious preferences of most of the market is going unmet. That is, if the state regulates the religious market to suppress competition, the favored religious organization will make very little effort to hold and attract support. There will be very little regard for religious demand. Moreover, the favored organization will tend to be controlled and staffed by careerists, often quite lacking in any religious motivation. And the net result is widespread public religious alienation, apathy, and of course, since most people are lacking any kind of real religious socialization and congregational support, their religious beliefs will get tentative, vague, eclectic, or to be more blunt about it, goofy, new age, whatever. Now, what happens if deregulation occurs in one of these markets? As we've seen, by the way, it's been going on in Italy. The result will be an outburst of pluralism. There's a market there. There's dissatisfaction there. And organizations will either move in or be organized or founded to meet many of these needs. And in the long run, what does that produce but a big revival? It means lots of people who found no church to go to now have a church finding them. And that's the important thing to remember. most of us really won't get around to doing much about religion unless some group comes and finds us and gets us interested in it and takes it to us. Mission is the basis of activity. With these points now in mind, let me get to my topic. I'm not going to run on all night, by the way. The topic tonight is subsidized religion, 6,000 years of negligence and laxity. So obviously I'm not going to focus on the Church of Sweden and the Church of England, but let me briefly mention a bit about the European situation as a background. Most social scientists involved in religion have spent at least the last century gleefully anticipating that their subject matter was going to disappear. Smart. What marketeers? The anthropologist Anthony F.C. Wallace wrote in a very well-known, well-supported textbook. This was back, first appeared in the 60s. The evolutionary future of religion is extinction. Belief in supernatural beings and in supernatural forces will become only an interesting historical memory. Belief in supernatural powers is doomed to die out all over the world as a result of the increasing adequacy and diffusion of scientific knowledge, and this process is inevitable. Shortly thereafter, an equally prominent fellow named Peter Berger rushed to tell the New York Times, by the 21st century, religious believers are likely to be found only in small sects, huddled together to resist the worldwide secular culture. The predicament of the believer is increasing like that of a Tibetan astrologer on a prolonged visit to an American university. He didn't know how we were going to lionize the Dalai Lama, of course, when he came. These predictions were known as the secularization thesis, since what was anticipated were secular societies. And the most compelling proof cited in support of the thesis were the empty churches in Western Europe. Consequently, through all these years, the continuing vigor of religion in America was dismissed by the secularization faithful as American exceptionalism. Much was written to explain why it was that the United States was failing to accompany more mature and more sophisticated European nations as they became fully modern, irreligious societies. And the consensus being that there was something seriously defective about American culture. Even Iceland was said to have achieved an advanced state of secularization while the United States continued to display the religiousness that was deemed appropriate only for backward nations. Of course, as so often happens, history didn't cooperate. In recent years, huge strides of modernization in Africa and Latin America and parts of Asia have been accompanied by a remarkable intensification of religion. Then came the dramatic collapse of the Soviet Union, bringing to an end a 70-year experiment in forced secularization. And its net result, as soon as it was, they felt secure enough to stop lying to pollsters, we discovered that only one Russian in 10 claims to be a non-believer. 70 years, and they got to 10%. Well, you can do that out in almost any tribe without any secularization efforts. It now appears the issue is not American exceptionalism, but European exceptionalism. Indeed, Peter Berger now recognizes the real question has become, why is Western Europe different? Of course, this shift took most of my colleagues by surprise, and some have responded, as you can imagine, by saying, well, I just haven't waited long enough. It's coming. It's coming. So others say, Those of us pursuing a market approach, of course, have said all along that low levels of church involvement in Europe have nothing to do with science or secularization, and everything to do with regulated and constrained religious markets that effectively prevent healthy competition. Protected and subsidized churches, not being dependent on public support, tend to be so negligent, lax, and lazy, they make little effort to arouse anybody's interest. As I mentioned earlier, this is critical because most of us aren't going to be involved in religion unless somebody stirs us up and makes an effort. As evidence, consider the fact that religious belief remains quite high in Europe. It's just nobody goes to church. Take Sweden. Only 9% even say that they go as often as once a month. 3% claim they go weekly. But nearly everybody believes in God, albeit some of them have rather odd ideas about what that term means, which would be expected if people have gone two or three generations without any institutional support for their belief. There's a woman in England answered a poll. This is wonderful. The question was a dumb question. Said, do you believe in an omnipotent God who can influence the course of history? She says, oh no, just the ordinary one. Oh yes. But the woman who got that response has responded by coming up with the notion of believing non-belongers to characterize the Europeans. Let's go back to Iceland. You know, that was the most, some people argue it was the most secularized nation on earth, leading the way. Only 2% claim to be atheists. So many people in Iceland believe in small supernatural creatures such as elves, trolls, and fairies that highways have been rerouted to avoid disturbing hills and rocks where they are thought to dwell. This is secularization. It might be goofy, but it's not secularization. This remarkable discrepancy reflects the fact that not only do clergy of established churches not need to court public support, many of them seem to prefer empty churches. Indeed, the one place where secularization has made deep inroads in Europe has been among the clergy of the established churches. Virtual atheism is quite common, is openly expressed by leading church figures, especially in the Protestant nations. In contrast, when Americans confront church leaders of this sort, and they do, they have a lot of attractive and energetic alternatives. So rather than stay away from church like the Europeans do, they stay away from those churches. You're all familiar with the declining statistics of some of what used to be called the mainline, now called the sideline. People will switch rather than quit when there's somebody competing for their attendance. There simply is no competition. They have a very lazy clergy. And this kind of approach not only seems to work in Europe, but has been confirmed in lots and lots and lots of other parts of the globe. The problem is, of course, with most social science, it's based on data from about 15 minutes ago, when in fact we're trying to build theories that are comprehensive in general and apply to the human experience. So, being very self-indulgent, I began to do history a few years ago as a way to test some of my theoretical notions and enabling me to stay home, run a gigantic account with Amazon Books, and have an awfully good time. And tonight I'd like to apply this little model to three ancient societies. Sumer, which was also known as Babylon, and Mesopotamia. Remember when we all learned to spell Mesopotamia? It also could apply it to Egypt in Greece. I'll spend more time on Sumer simply because we have so much more information. It's the oldest of these societies, but they had the good sense to write on clay and bake it. And so we've got hundreds of thousands of clay cylinders. We even have priestly training manuals. We could easily, as a matter of fact, reenact most of their important rituals because the directions come down to us. What all three of these societies had are what I call temple religions. These are religions that are staffed by an exclusive priesthood. They serve a clientele rather than a membership. Clients come to a temple to participate in periodic festivals and ceremonies, and sometimes appear there in pursuit of personal and material returns, but their temple activity is relatively incidental to their social relationships and to their self-conceptions. People go to temples, they don't belong to them. In contrast, there are religions that are able to generate congregations, that is to say, communities of participants whose religious life is of substantial importance for their social relationships and their self-conceptions. Look, no Greeks walked around claiming to be Zeusians. No Sumerians claimed to be Eluleans. Not like people who claim to be Christians or Jews or Mithraists. Temple religions differ in their inclusiveness, but most of them limit their clientele to the social elite, although some of them offer a bit of access to the public. This exclusiveness reflects, in part, that temple religions usually are fully subsidized state monopolies, and they don't need to see people in the pews in order to do very well indeed. Now for the details. From the earliest days, Sumerians built enormous temples. It's amazing, some of them going back to, say, 3500 BCE. You've got buildings, a whole set of buildings, several of them the size of American football fields. Of course, they're all falling down, but, you know, we dig them up. They were constructed of mud bricks, think adobe. And all their floor plans provided an area for periodic public rites. Most temple activities were closed to the public. Many interior rooms were devoted to all sorts of secret and sacred rites, including the holiest place of all, the sanctuary housing the god. Now, the temples that were built in Sumer have some interesting features. They seem to have provided tombs, usually unoccupied, of course, where the gods were to be buried, which was in keeping with the way they lived. By the way, almost all Neolithic societies did this, which is buried your family members in the house. Just under the, you know, dirt floor, dig a hole in the floor, put them in. Sometimes they've dug up a house that would have 40 or 50 people in the living room. This was the way it was done. It was a very important religious significance. These people tended to worship their ancestors. And in that sense, you see, you had these empty rooms in these temples because the temple was the house of the god. This is where the god lived. These gods, of course, were huge, usually. They were made of very precious wood. They were covered with gold, except where they put garments to cover the wood. They had those characteristic staring eyes made out of shells and precious stones, sumptuous garments, crowned with tiaras, And they were regarded as living beings. Now, I know when I was in school, and probably when most of you, we were somehow, if these things about idols ever came up, we were kind of told, well, they knew that those were just statues. I mean, when they prayed to the moose, to the god, it was, you know. No. They thought these things were alive. How do we know that? Well, first of all, there were priests assigned to bathe them, dress them, and feed them. They were offered special foods and wines and ate behind a curtain. Construction and repair involved enormous secrecy. Building one was even more secret. But why do we know about all of this and that the fact that they really thought they were alive? Because we have all of the books, all of the rituals by which they brought them to life, or thought they did. Extremely elaborate. Took weeks and weeks and weeks. In one step, they sew a golden turtle inside a living turtle and throw it in the river. But all the way, it's clear that they mean to bring these statues to life. And it wasn't just in Sumer. It was pretty much this way throughout civilization at this time. Now, what about these priests? It was a slightly different profession than what we mean by priest or priestess today. They performed no pastoral functions, partly because they didn't serve congregations. Instead, their focus was on performing rituals and on service to the gods, not to humanity. Plato explained, priests understand how to offer our gifts to the gods in sacrifices in a manner pleasing to them, and they know, too, the right forms of prayer for petitioning the gods to bestow blessings on their worshipers. Put another way, priests are religious specialists. The priests of Sumer were a highly trained, closed, professional guild. Most were descended from priestly families, all underwent extensive training, all of it devoted to ritual. We find almost no theological writings to have survived, and they would have survived. They specialized. Some conducted major rituals. Some fed the images of the gods. Some bathed the images. Some were exorcists and treated the ill. And they formed a closed society with its own rules, its own traditions, its own rites. And how did they live? Well, the phrase was, they lived off the altar, which is to say, all of these things brought to the gods. Well, somebody had to do something with them, and they did. Now, Greece was a little bit different. Things were a little bit more relaxed. The priesthood was a little bit more open. It was hereditary. But it wasn't a very demanding kind of closed group. And the fees were modest. And the people were part-timers. Now remember, in this time, the notion of state church would have been incomprehensible because nobody distinguished between the state and the church. Remember, you know, we all know what the Acropolis is. Well, all ancient cities were built on the Acropolis model, which means, if possible, up on a hill, otherwise you build a platform. You put the palace and the temple up above the rest of the city. And that was the god's temple and the king's castle. But the king was often head of the church. Sometimes, as in Egypt, the king, the pharaoh, was thought to be a god. It's interesting to find words like God's vicar and whatnot appearing in writings from 6,000 years ago. The obvious thing that follows from this lack of any separation between state and church is that the priests were fully subsidized religious monopolists. They were opposed to change. Why? Well, I'll tell you how opposed to change were. Every time whether these adobe temples wore out, they built another one on top of the old one with exactly the same floor plan. Century after century after century, millennium after millennium, the thing got higher and higher and higher. The last churches were being built about 50 or 60 feet off the ground. But it was always exactly the same temple. And we look at the various rituals and prayers and things that have come down to us, and we look at a ritual 1,600 years apart, word for word, the same. Nothing changed. Well, priests don't like change. First, one thing, of course, once you've learned all this stuff, you certainly don't want it to become outmoded. I mean, we all know that. You know, I wish my education were all outmoded. Excuse me. Secondly, when you learn all this stuff, you discover there's a correct way and an incorrect way. Therefore, innovation is error. So they clung to their religious culture. They were a professional priesthood. There was a second reason nothing changed: cynicism. Here you've got these people, generation after generation in a family. This is the family's business. This is what they do for a living. There's no notion here that you need to be called. There's no idea here that you need to be religiously motivated. That doesn't even arise. It's your family job. It's your privilege. They don't need to exhibit a calling any more than they do in, say, the Church of England or among Scandinavian pastors today. And the priests became all too aware that the idols probably weren't alive. They knew who really drank the wine and ate the food behind the screen. And their cynicism made them unsusceptible to any kind of religious reformer, religious innovator. They really didn't care that much about religion. They had it all down pat anyway. So why not? The fact of the matter is, they had a marvelous thing going in all of these societies. They didn't need a congregation. They didn't need to be popular. Because, well, in Sumer, the gods ate twice a day, at dawn again in the evening. They got the finest food the society could provide. Well, guess who ate it? The same was true of the jewels and the robes and the other valuables that were brought and received by the priesthood. As I said, they lived off the altar. But they lived off something else. In all cases, there were enormous subsidies, usually based on temple lands. For example, in Sumer, there were probably 30 to 40% of the land belonged to the temples. None of that, but this was, by the way, in Greece, it was about 10 to 15%. But in both societies, you've got this wonderful little tradition, which is the lay folk out there have got to volunteer a number of days a year to work the temple lands. And consequently, they had a very nice thing going. And consequently, the public be damned in the most explicit way, actually. This was fully anticipated by Adam Smith more than two centuries ago. I wish I'd read him before I started doing this stuff, but I didn't. I'm kind of proud I got to the same place on my own, but he says it so wonderfully. Religious leaders may either depend altogether for their subsistence on voluntary contributions, or they may derive it from some other fund to which the law of their country may entitle them, such as a landed estate, a tithe, or a land tax, an established salary, or a stipend. He didn't know, of course, that priests in much of Northern Europe would someday be civil servants, but he anticipated it. Their exertion, their zeal, and industry are likely to be much greater in the former situation when they depend on voluntary payment than in the latter, wherein the clergy, reposing themselves upon their benefices, neglect to keep up the further of faith and devotion of the great body of the people, and having given themselves up to indolence, are become altogether incapable of making any vigorous exertion in defense even of their own establishment. Such a clergy have commonly no other resource to call upon than the government, to go to the civil magistrate to persecute, destroy, or drive out their adversaries. Smith's description seems quite accurate when applied to the monopoly religions of temple times. Then, as later, they were content to live off their benefices, as he would put it. Indeed, they cared so little about the public that most Sumerian temple rituals were attended only by priests and sometimes by various members of the upper nobility. Nobody else was permitted in. There were, of course, ceremonies held in the temple every day. Large amounts of food was eaten, wine drunk, all of it for the gods, you know. But there weren't any ordinary citizens coming here with their supplications. You know why? Because they couldn't get in. Not only that, but even though there was a public area, you couldn't see God from there. These temples were built so that the god was tucked in a niche or at a right angle to the public area. Only the priests and the political elite were admitted to the area from which a god could be seen. These, of course, were state temples. The priests had no need to engender any support. The king was the supreme priest. He also built the temples and supported them. But mostly the public was excluded as a simple matter of disdain. The masses were not fit to share in the spiritual life. Temples in Egypt were also limited in terms of public access. No one but priests and a few high officials could even enter the temples. Maybe it's this reason that they had no lay audience that all scholars are agreed that rituals conducted in the Egyptian temples were, to quote one of the great writers, mindless. No spontaneous behavior ever took place. Now, in Greece, things were more public. The Greeks, of course, had some democracy, and they had a little less of a lot of things going against the masses, if you will. And consequently, as we'll see in a minute, the Greeks come out a little bit differently on this. But in any event, if all significant religious rites and worship activities are hidden from view, as they were in Egypt and Sumer, what's to inspire the people to faith? And the answer is very little, and they didn't have much. All of the famous scholars of Mesopotamia, Sumer, whatever we want to call it, said that the people basically were uninvolved in religion. They were simply onlookers to certain public ceremonies. They lived in a, quote, quite tepid religious climate. As a matter of fact, they were pretty much on their own for any kind of religion. They did have some small shrines. They did conduct various rituals out in the open in front of the house. As I said, they did bury people in their homes. There were probably some local shaman, some local mystics wandering around, doing some exorcism, doing a little of this, doing a little of that. Had to keep a pretty low profile, because if they got very successful, they, of course, would have been suppressed. Now, as I said a minute ago, Greece was a little bit more open, and consequently, there were sects that sprang up in Greece from time to time. The Pythagoreans, followers of Orpheus, they were real sects in the sense that they were quite aesthetic. They were upper class, but they had a lot of routines and rules. They were vegetarians. They drank no wine. They encouraged celibacy. Some became wandering beggars. The Orphics had rules against speaking in the dark. They wore white clothing. They were a good old bunch. And it happened because there was just enough looseness in the situation for some other religious groups to spring up. And with a little bit of the lid raised, there they were. In fact, if you don't repress religion, you will get religions. Consequently, the Greek public, general public in the times you're talking about, was probably more religious than were the people in Egypt or the people in Sumer. So, let me wind up. Starting with the first civilizations and continuing down to the present, subsidized religions who ignored the religious needs of the general public. This always results in widespread religious apathy, since, as I've said, it requires vigorous, organized effort to produce high levels of public religious commitment. That's why a wonderful historian named Anthony Spollinger remarked that religion in ancient Egypt resembled the Church of England rather than Methodism. To pursue this comparison, the Church of England has always permitted the general public, of course, to enter its churches and even to sit down if, until recently, they were able and willing to pay a substantial pew rental fee. But it always has been quite uncertain whether access to an Anglican church will provide parishioners with a lot of religious satisfaction. Back in 1520, when the new Bishop of Oxford set out to visit each of his 193 parishes, he found that in 58 cases, the parson was absent, having moved to town for the winter and suspended services. They were, of course, in all those instances, still being paid. Indeed, in the 18th century, of course, along came the Methodists. When it was legal to do so, they started challenging, and they launched campaigns to build public religious enthusiasm. The word enthusiasm soon took on such dreadful meaning among the upper classes, and especially the Anglican priests, that there's a gravestone of a prominent Anglican cleric where it says, "He served the church for many years without enthusiasm." No doubt. Thank you.
Thank you for that enthusiastic lecture. Rodney's happy to answer a few questions. There are microphones located there and there. If you would come and ask your question there, because we will be on NPT. television, please.
I'd like to know what your thesis would say about modern Islam.
One of the great, and I must thank some Islamic friends for educating me, particularly Mansour Mwaddal. One of the great mistakes that we make in the West when we look at Islam is the same mistake they make when they look at us, which is we see a monolith and they see a monolith. My friend Mansour tells me that if I were to go to him with him to a small Muslim village with four mosques, he could show me the Baptist mosque, the Episcopalian mosque, the Unitarian mosque, and the Catholic mosque. That in fact there's an enormous amount of real pluralism, real sectarianism, that we find it very hard to see. Although it's pretty clear that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood and whatnot is you know, that's not the Church of Islam. I mean, you know, there are all kinds of sects inside Islam, always have been, and it's one of the reasons that it's so energetic. Now, the state involvement has probably been in the past bad for them. We also get the notion that everybody was some kind of raving fanatic Muslim. Not true. You know, I mean, they had, you know, most everybody didn't go to the mosque until suddenly nationalism comes in, and now if you're not a very devout Muslim, you're probably not a good nationalist either. And all these things get mixed in together. But it's a much, much more interesting... Okay, for example, there's a wonderful study a historian has done. Islam swept over North Africa, okay? Those all became Islamic societies, right? Well, if you're interested in treaties and you're interested in war, that's true. But if you're interested in conversion, it turns out that it was many, many generations before most people in those societies actually, officially became Muslims. We know that because there have been wonderful books of names, and you can go through the names, and until a certain kinds of names start appearing in the family tree, those aren't Muslims, okay? I was very shocked at that, but North Africa stayed non-Muslim for hundreds of years, but politically completely Muslim, in the sense that that's what the rulers were. Anybody? Oh.
Yes, I just wanted to first of all direct attention to the fact that the temples in Sumer that you referred to, the earliest evidence of writing we have in them, are actually rationalists for the distribution of grain, oxen, and other kinds of things, which had a direct economic function in the society vis-a-vis those villages that were not participating in that religion. I think you make a mistake of emphasizing too much supposed belief systems of these people and the real functions of temple and churches. But having said that, I would pose my question, which is, in the nature of the relationship between economics and religion today in the United States, to what extent would you interpret the role of religion in an economic sense in the increased militarization of this civilization, the wedding of the political agenda and the religious agenda into an empire?
I'm not going to answer that because this is a public occasion and I'm on my best manners. I'm not going to answer the last part of it. I don't know that I stress the religion of the Sumerians and things so much. As a matter of fact, the priests sound kind of irreligious and the people were just kind of left to wander. By the way, while it's true in some of these places that almost all of the early writing was economic, that's not true in Sumer. It's heavily religious from day one. Of course, you know, the sheep and the goats are there too, but it's not, I'm trying to think of the society where everything basically was accounting for a very, very long time. You're quite right about that.
Victory of Reason, you describe how modern science and free markets and political freedoms had their origin in the Middle Ages in Western Europe, and yet, obviously, in the medieval times in Western Europe, you had an established church. I was just wondering if you could clarify.
Sure. I mean, there was a reason that behind every bush there was a heretic, and the sect was breaking out all over Europe. Sure, the church was trying to keep a lid on, and it did so reasonably well from time to time. And one of the very overlooked things is the incredible ability of the Roman Catholic Church to have internal sects. Every single one of the new monastic movements would have ended up being the new Assemblies of God or whatever, but they managed to turn it into a religious order, and they put up with an enormous amount of heresy. That would say, what would have been heresy if any layman had said it? As long as they stayed inside the church. It was brilliant, but it also made for an enormous variety, so that, for example, as capitalism is coming along, and the great monasteries are being involved in lending money at interest and all this sort of thing, there were some people in the church who said, these are usurers, and they're all going to go to hell, and maybe they should go there sooner rather than later. But there were also some of the other monastic orders. Thomas Aquinas was in one and said, well, now, just a second. What's so bad about commerce? And these things seem to be working. They completely rethought the whole economic model that all religions mostly have, which is economics is bad, profit is terrible, we should all be aesthetics. But in fact, they worked it through, and when they were done, usury was still against church law, but you no longer could figure out what it meant. Because it was okay to lend money and to do all of these things as long as there was adventure involved, that is to say, there were some risks. It was a fantastic sort of thing that went on.
Hi, thank you for your lecture tonight. I was hoping that you could elaborate a little bit on what you meant by a religious market economy, and that pluralism is the natural mode of things. For example, to draw an analogy, if my car is running low on gas, I might have a favorite gas station, but if it's more convenient to go to a different gas station, I can expect that their fuel will have a similar octane, and so my car will run just fine. But religions have to do with beliefs, and so can we say that our religions contain equal distributions of truth?
Absolutely not. And I'll tell you something. I often talk about high-octane and low-octane religions. Okay? And in fact, if you knew that this station down here with the flying zebra on it had the 27-octane knock-knock-knock gas, you wouldn't go in there. Well, there are some... Over the course of time, there are denominations that, once had 80 octane, probably never had 90. Get down into the 30s, and you know what? Nobody is getting their car filled there anymore. We have seen a wonderful thing in this country is the level of religion stays the same, but where it's coming from differs one generation to the next quite markedly. When I was a kid leaving for college, going to go out and play football, somebody asked me, what's the religious situation going to be like in Jamestown, North Dakota, which is where I'm from? What's it going to be like 40 years from now? I said, well, town will still be about half Catholic. The Lutherans ever get together, they might be the biggest, but if they don't, and they probably won't, we had, I think, 14 kinds of Lutherans, Finnish and German and Swedish and, you name it. It'll still be the Methodists and the Presbyterians. They got the biggest buildings now. They'll have the biggest buildings then. At that time, the Assemblies of God met in a remodeled one-bedroom apartment over an auto parts shop. And the Nazarenes, I played ball with the Nazarenes preacher's son. He was a good pitcher. They had moved an old country schoolhouse to town and put a steeple on it. You go back to Jamestown today, there's nobody in the Methodist Church, there's nobody in the Presbyterian Church. The Lutherans haven't gotten it together. Town is still about half Catholic. But you couldn't get the Nazarene Church choir into their old church. And the Assemblies of God who were up in that apartment of the biggest church in town got three pastors. Is Jamestown more religious than it was when I was a kid? Absolutely not. It's just that the kids, you know, the people I grew up with, changed churches. There's as much religion as ever, but they're getting it somewhere else. And basically, in that kind of a situation, the churches that work at it thrive. And if you get lazy, you die. I mean, it really is simple.
It's not so much a matter of which church is distributing the most religious activity, but which church is distributing the most truth.
Well, I don't know how, as a sociologist, now I'm a human being, I do make judgments like that, but as a sociologist, I don't know how to deal with that conceptually. All I can say is that if you've got a real hazy conception of God, that doesn't seem to appeal very much. Let me tell you about the Washington Cathedral. I've never been in it, never met the people. There are some of Schuller's people from Los Angeles. They came to Seattle. They haunted the neighborhoods. They finally figured out where to buy an old cheap barn and get started. And now it's this great big church. I had to drive by there pretty often, and through the years, I saw their marquee. They put up stuff. And I don't know what truth they were offering much, but I can tell you why they grew. One of their early signs was first Sunday service, 6 p.m. Saturday. And then the line, take her to church and then to dinner. And then I drove by once and it said, church camp starts June 20th. Bible. Horseback riding. Spanish. Karate. And you know, those kids in the cars going by, they're like, Mom, I want to go to Bible camp, you know. I mean, you know, it was brilliant. And say, well, now, when I tell this to some of my English friends, they say, oh, my God, how tasteless. And I say, hey, there was Bible, and I'll bet the Spanish, when they were taking Spanish, they were doing Bible. Don't know what they were reading on the horse, but they got the kids there. It's all well and good to be, you know, this intellectual purism and have three kids at your Bible camp. And that's what I mean by competition, is that there were other churches in that immediate area that picked right up on that. Or you can go to Latin America. You've got all these Protestants running all over Latin America now. What's interesting is what the Catholic Church is doing. In December, the Catholic Church in Argentina declared itself free of state subsidy. They're going to make it on their own from here on. They don't want any state money. They don't want the connection. We're going to be like the Pentecostals. We'll be much better for it. Seminary enrollments, Catholic seminary enrollments, are doing this in Latin America for the first time in history. Why? Because they've had to suddenly compete. There are wonderful books about the Catholic Church in America in the 19th century when they got off the boats and started hitting this kind of a market economy. They did wonderful things. They learned how to hold revival meetings in about 10 minutes. They did something else. In the 1880s, Rockefeller gave the Baptists 6 chapel cars. And they'd haul them all around the railroads, all over the West, they'd take them to a mining town. It held 100 people. It had a little organ. And there was a little apartment for the preacher and his wife. And they'd park it on a siding, and they'd hold church. They'd hold church until they got enough of a congregation going, so it was self-sustaining. They'd haul it on to the next town. 18 months, and the Catholics had three chapel cars out there of their own. They said, these miners are our people, and they're taking them. And then, of course, you go and look at the Catholics in Europe. They weren't doing anything like that, or in Latin America. Why in the world has the American Catholic Church always been regarded with suspicion in Rome? Because it's a very different and a very activist Catholic Church. And that wasn't a matter of, Rome sending down the word. That was these guys looking around and saying, all these Irish getting off the boat are make-believe Catholics. They hardly have ever gone to Mass. If we're going to lose them to the Baptists if we don't get out there and get them to Mass. And so Mass attendance was enormously high in this country. Then they decided you didn't have to go every Sunday, and it went down a little bit. What did they think? You tell me I can sleep in once or twice a month, I'm not going to do it? Is this enough?
Yeah. Thank you very much. Same time, same place, 2 weeks, Rodney is back. See you then. Thank you.